The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, according to new research, stars similar to our own sun may produce solar superflares about once per century. And after the death of American filmmaker David Lynch, we'll speak with a film studies professor about how Lynch's films impacted him and his students. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Filmmaker David Lynch died this month. The pioneering director and artist created works that have been puzzling, repulsing, and captivating audiences since his 1977 debut, Eraserhead, through the third and final season of his television series Twin Peaks in 2017. Lynch's films had a profound effect on University at Albany film studies professor Rick Barney. Barney taught a course on Lynch's unique camera techniques, a class he tells me brought together his personal and professional interests.
When I was in grad school, 1979, I went to see Eraserhead in what was then the only way you could see it, which is a kind of a midnight movie situation. And as I wrote to Lynch much later, when he was very cautiously approaching being interviewed, I said, because the only language I could think of was this, the top of my head came off, which is sort of how you experience it psychologically, because your mind is just blown. You can hardly believe what you're seeing. It's enrapturing. It's horrifying. It's strangely appealing. And I simply said at that moment, I have to see everything this guy makes right after this. So that's exactly what happened. I got to the 90s, began my career as a professor, and then slowly decided, well, yeah, I can figure this out. I can make this appeal to my colleagues who are the ones who have to agree when they set up a schedule. The thing about Lynch is that there is a very deceptive appearance in the way he talks and the way he presents himself, which is quite literally an aw shucks golly gee. He's really well known for these kinds of folksy ways of talking, but the thing you can already tell, but you certainly do when you talk to him in person, is that there was an enormous intelligence there, just incredible. He would not have thought of himself as an intellectual. He was actually a little nervous around academic types, university professor types like me. But the amount of smarts going on there was just phenomenal.
What were you able to communicate with him?
Well, I had to really work at it to make it a successful encounter. I interviewed him three times. And the first really was just kind of a trial balloon, I realized. I was trying to get places with it, but it really was just about us becoming familiar. Because when I first started talking to him in the year 2000, he still said that he wasn't really very good with words. One of his former lovers, Isabella Wasolini, used to call the time when she was with him in the late 70s and 80s his pre-verbal stage.
Wow.
So he will just say flat out that he doesn't particularly think of himself as having a strong suit in talking.
But did you get the impression that he was observing? I mean, David Lynch had practiced transcendental meditation and was always talking about the world and what's around us and drawing inspiration from sort of from being. Did you get a sense that when he was speaking with you that he was also taking a lot in and observing you while you were reacting and speaking with him?
Certainly, to some degree. The thing is that for all of his hesitation to explain things or to respond to some kinds of questions, he's an incredible conversationalist. I mean, the one thing I knew was working, even the very first time we met, was that they had set this time period, like I think it was an hour, maybe hour and 15 minutes, and his assistants had to come in like three times to say, David, you're running over time. So I knew that then we were probably going to be, we would get somewhere eventually, even though it took a while. Because he's notoriously, I'm going to I'm pausing here because it's inevitable. I'm going to shift in and out of present and past tense because I'm still dealing with the fact that he's not with us now. If that's the case, it's really about the way I'm still living with this and the way it's still alive for me, which I think is the only consolation all of us have now, given the loss. But I knew that if we just kept talking, we would find interesting things, and we did. Sometimes I would be surprised by something I thought was casual in my remark or question, and he would really pause over that. Other times, one of his responses was, "Well, that's your thing." Because we're not going there. It was his very pleasant way of saying what he wasn't willing to do. But man, we could talk. I mean, I realized that it's part of his creativity that things do not go in a straight line, even if you're just talking. And there's a kind of, it's not really meandering, but it can deflect and go in a new direction at any moment, and you just have to be ready for it as best you can be. So that's really fascinating because it's a part of trying to interview a person like him that is, of course, also very relevant to the kinds of movies that he makes. These are well-known stories. He really believes in chance when he's already got a complete script. Everything is set out. He knows how everything's supposed to go, and then an accident happens or something that wasn't planned. And Lynch will go, "Oh, that's got now has to be in the movie." That's how we get the character Bob from Twin Peaks. We were never supposed to see Bob, but an accidental angle with a mirror and a camera in one of the scenes he was shooting led to one of the assistants saying, "David, we have a problem." "Oh, what's the problem?" "Well, one of the grips, one of the assistants for carrying props and whatever, had been caught in that mirror, crouching behind a chair."
With the wild hair and the outfit and everything.
Yeah, it was almost like destiny, because he had the look that was terrifying when they actually put him on screen. But Lynch thought about it. They reshot that scene. But then he realized, no, actually, Bob is supposed to be in the movie.
So I wanted to just back up a little bit and talk about your teaching and working with students and showing them the works of David Lynch. And a focus of your course was the volitional camera, which I'm pretty sure I know what you mean if you've seen any of David Lynch's films, where sort of the camera will move away from what's supposed to be on screen or what the audience might supposed to be on screen. But maybe you can help explain it. Why did you want to focus on that?
Well, two things. One thing, if you're teaching in film studies, you're always wanting students to know about past movies, film history, what's gone on before, and how are directors responding, even if they don't tell you that they're responding to those kinds of movies. And again, while Lynch does not intellectualize his work, it's very clear that he's watched The Surrealists, and he's watched Hitchcock, and he's watched, you know, on and on. So I set up initially, the way the course was structured, was something I called David Lynch and His Others, which was pairing one of his movies with some earlier film. So the students would get a little bit of film history and then understand a little bit more about why Lynch was doing what he was doing as a response. So as an example, we did Andalusian Dog along with Eraserhead. And I just said, "Okay, guys, this was his first feature film, so you're just going to have to get used to this. This is going to be one of the stranger of the ones we'll watch, but you're going to get the full treatment here one way or another." But we basically, without thinking of him as derivative, thought of him as responding to that kind of thing. The other thing, though, you've just mentioned, the camera very often seems to have a mind of its own, but it's not associated with any one person or character. So usually when the camera starts moving or tracking in certain ways, we assume it's representation of someone walking or turning their head or whatever. But Lynch will, in a certain way, animate the camera, and it will do stuff that no character's doing or could do. And I ask the students to figure out what is this for? Why does Lynch keep doing this? Because we tracked it from early, way back into Eraserhead, all the way into Mulholland Drive. I haven't taught the course since his last feature film came out, Inland Empire, but it's there too. And it's also there in the third season of Twin Peaks, which is the last major thing he did for Showtime some time ago. And I'm still working on it myself. I haven't written it up yet. I've given lectures and talks and incorporated it into classes. But there's something, I mean, Lynch is always interested in things that take us out of ourselves. Our typical way of seeing things, our habits of mind, our assumptions, even our preferences. And I think that he brings that over to the camera as well. The camera becomes, if you will, inhabited by something that's going to be more than us. In a sense, the camera becomes more than just a tool or a thing we use, but a thing that may, in fact, use us or bring us places we don't have any desire or plan to get there. So I'm really fascinated by that because, you know, I think it would be wrong to say that Lynch believes in all these worlds that he's given us in those movies. He didn't believe in that specific world, but he was absolutely fascinated with finding new worlds, however he could get there, whatever means, strange stories, odd use of camera, the visualizations. He was always trying. His famous saying was that when he wants to get his best experience from a movie, it would be to make him dream. And I didn't know what that meant for a while, but I think that dreaming is about the possibility of other worlds and other possibilities.
David Lynch was an artist, a visual artist, in addition to being a filmmaker. When you are teaching film students, do you ever take that example and maybe encourage, or have you encouraged students to take up another kind of course that explores creativity, sculpture, or painting, or something along those lines? You know, when I was in school, I was a communications major, and then I had to take a minor, and I asked why, and they said, well, because you need something to communicate about, right? So, you know, when you are exploring film with students, have you ever had that conversation with having them explore other forms of art?
There are some students who were wanting to get into filmmaking. There were students who were maybe painters or had other things that they wanted to do that way. And I was always intrigued by whether or not they decided to use any of that or it found its way into some of their work. But sometimes, to tell you the truth, my focus was not on them because those folks were already on a track for creative thinking and mm-hmm. exploration. It was more your student who'd never thought about anything like that, whose mind was being bent by the movies. And I was interested in, well, where can you go with that now? How can you write something for me or something for the class that will engage you and not just be an assignment? I was always looking for those things. I never made it an official part of the course. You have to go make a small video now with your iPhone. I never did anything like that, but I do wonder what it'd be like to attempt that. I know others have done that for sure.
So now with news that David Lynch has died, are you going to revisit the course? Would you like to revisit the course?
I really would. It would be now a different kind of course. Probably the volitional camera will probably be in there, of course, but I don't know yet. I'm still processing us losing him, and so I don't know how I will come at a course in a way that'll fit the moment that we're in, 2025. My feelings right now are very often what we have when people are lost to us. One is the sorrow, and the other is the gratitude. It's just a very weird combination, at least for me right now, of sadness because of his being gone. But then there's the thankfulness to have met him, had those kind of encounters, and then just having the work. So it's this very incongruous combination of feeling, and I'm going to have to wade through that for a while before I reach a point. I don't have to propose a course for a few more months, so I'm going to let it take its time to develop. And or something will show up out of the blue in Lynchian fashion, and I'll know exactly what it's supposed to be.
And lastly, if somebody has never seen a David Lynch film, do you have a favorite, or maybe do you have a recommendation on where to start?
Yeah, that's a tough one. because Eraserhead remains one of my favorites, but it is one of the hardest ones to really get access to in terms of understanding. I would say Mulholland Drive. I think I would say start with Mulholland Drive. Fabulous acting, fascinating and strange story, but it has something that is a little easier to latch onto to get a sense of what he's up to. You got to go from there to Blue Velvet. if that's working for you, do Lost Highway and get to Eraserhead at some point. If no other reason, then Lynch did say to me several times that he hoped that Eraserhead was the one for the ages. It remained his favorite, despite my interviewing him 30 years, almost 30 years later, about his career as a whole. And so if you kind of want to know what the director thought, this is my stuff. This is where, there you have it. A movie that took 5 years to make, partly supported by delivering newspapers on a bicycle, borrowing from his family, working whenever he could, hand to mouth, with a handful of actors and people participating that were not even in the movie but were supporting it. People like Sissy Spacek. I mean, it's a movie that does just stand out there. I have no idea what history is going to do. Maybe they'll decide it's another movie that's the best Lynch one, but you should get there sooner or later.
Thanks for coming in, Rick. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Rick Barney is a professor of film studies at the University at Albany. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Solar flares occur when stars, like our own sun, release massive amounts of electromagnetic radiation and can occur multiple times a day. Super flares, thousands of times more powerful, are far less common. New research studied brightness measurements from 56,000 sun-like stars taken by the Kepler Space Telescope and found that such superflares can occur about once per century per star. To learn more, I spoke with Valery Vasilyev at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Germany.
When we're talking about superflares, it's all about the energy of the process. So from the sun, again, we learned that the solar flare energy range spans many orders of magnitude. Now it will be maybe, I will use some physical terms to describe it. So the largest solar flare observed so far has an energy of a few times to 10 to 32 ergs. So this is a physical term to describe amount of energy. When we are talking about super flares, these are events at least an order or two orders of magnitude much more more energetic than the observed so far solar flares.
So how far away are these super flares that the Kepler telescope has observed from our own solar system?
From our sample, we detected super flares within 3,000-5,000 light years away from the Earth. That's like the order of the distance.
Now, is it possible that our own sun could also experience such a large solar flare or a super flare?
This is a very good question. There is no answer saying only yes or only no. It's complicated to answer because, again, we need to observe our sun for quite a long time. Already over 200 years of 300 years of observations, we know that the sun also changes its activity level. For example, at the beginning of 18th century, it was so-called Maunder minimum, when we really didn't see clear evidence of solar activity, no sunspots observed on the surface. So we cannot really say from that point of view that the sun will definitely create a super flare in next 50 or 100 years. It's difficult to say.
So there's a much longer time period when we're talking about solar activity. This is something that would happen over many hundreds or thousands or even longer of years before we could see these significant changes, is what you're saying.
Yes, and there are also changes in the solar activity level itself because there are periods of activity minimum, activity maximum, and then there are larger scale modulations. So to give a clear answer regarding our sun, we of course have to observe it for a long time. Another way, of course, is to observe stars that are similar to our sun if we believe that their properties, like temperatures, masses, stellar variability, or chemical composition, are similar to our sun, then we again assume that these stars are representative to our sun, and then we can extrapolate their super or project their super flare frequency to our sun. But one has to be, of course, careful. If you follow the second approach, this is also what we did in our study. We can assume that we don't see anything against this.
If such a superflare were to happen in our own solar system, what would be the effects on Earth or surrounding planets?
Wow, that's a very good question. And I would say shortly that it's a matter of separate study, but of course, we can shortly say that it will affect all satellite communication, I suppose, space communication. It might create quite strong geomagnetic storms. Also, the impact of this event might depend on is the flare accompanied by the ejection of plasma, because that can cause extra perturbations of our atmosphere. For example, in 1980, I think nine, it was a relatively strong solar flare accompanied with the coronal mass ejection. And I think something like 6 million people suffered from a blackout in Quebec, Canada, because of perturbations of the coming from the geomagnetic storm to an electric system. So it's yeah, and here in our study, we're talking about events that are 100,000 times stronger. So you can try to scale already what can be potential impact if it's accompanied with the ejection of plasma that can hit the Earth. Because we cannot say that every super flare that is accompanied by expulsion of plasma will definitely hit the Earth because of, again, trajectory of these particles.
Now, this has been a very active year for solar activity in our own solar system. Here, I'm in the northeastern United States, and in October, I was able to see the northern lights. What are the research opportunities during these very active solar periods in our own solar systems? What can we learn from solar cycles like the one we're currently experiencing?
There are various aspects because every 5 years, every several years, we launch new instruments. We observe our sun with better precision, which gives us much more information regarding how this flaring occurs, how again, this cloud of plasma travels across the solar system, how this hint happens and how our geomagnetic magnetosphere of the Earth is impacted. We can study it in much more detail. Additionally, we collect more statistics. We can much better constrain the flare properties. And on top of that, we have to keep in mind that every solar cycle is particular. We don't have solar cycles that are exactly the same. And maybe we can try to better constrain behavior of the solar activity itself. On top, I think it's also nice subject to understand how these strong events affect our space electronics, because there are many telescopes operating in a space environment, and there are new missions also planned. Somebody is already talking about colonization of Mars, and it's maybe nice to understand how organic materials can be damaged. What is the impact of this high energetic particles, and I think it would be nice to see some experiments happening near the Earth and on a satellite. I think there are various ways of studying this. In event that you mentioned in May, I also saw these Northern Lights here in Germany, and later this year I saw already quite nice papers studying this event in particular. There were aspects related how this electromagnetic burst on the solar surface happened. What was the configuration of these spots that created such complex magnetic field structure? Then the burst itself, and then propagation of the coronal mass ejection itself, how particles accelerated. I saw already several papers related to this particular event, observed also with new instruments.
Where is your research going to take you next? Obviously, there's a lot of exciting developments that are here or are on the horizon, but what are you specifically most excited about or interested in right now?
I'm interested to apply my method to detect super flares to large amount of data that we already have, for example, from American NASA MIT TESS telescope, then to apply my method to the European data. It will start collecting data from 2026. Yeah, because we can extend this to stars that are slightly hotter than our sun, slightly cooler, to really understand this flaring phenomenon, how it changes across stars with different radius, with different parameters. Because we know that there are planets, exoplanets around different types of stars. And one of the ingredients that can be important for life, of course, is radiation coming from the star. If it's too strong, it will be likely against forming complex molecules. If there are some flares, it might trigger some chemical reactions and forming molecules. So that there are like various directions really in which I'm really interested and looking forward to analyze new data. And of course, I'm also going to check JWST data as well. We have some ideas on what we can learn.
Valery Vasilyev is a researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1790. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.